This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Fletcher.
The salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And Dialed In never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to the show trainers listen to. This is Trainer Talk, and it's presented by Fasig Tipton right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you once again on this Wednesday afternoon and ready to roll for the next hour all across North America on Sirius 219, XM 201, and, of course, streaming live or podcast on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today I have the privilege of welcoming the native of Lafayette, Louisiana, who has saddled 569 career winners with purse earnings in excess of $14 million since he began training in the late 1980s. He is fresh off his first graded stakes win in the Grade 2 Prioress at Saratoga this past Saturday with Scylla, but that's kind of sort of, I guess, if you want to look at it that way. I'll tell you more about that in just a minute, but let's do it now. Let's welcome trainer Brett Brinkman to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Brett, appreciate the visit.
Good morning. I appreciate you calling me and putting me on.
Yeah, excited to hear your story and to hear what it was like growing up in Lafayette and being around horses for the first time. But let's start. Let's not bury the lead. Let's start with that Grade 2 Prioress. I said sort of your first graded stakes victory of your career. That's because of the fact that you sent the horse to New York to be saddled by Charlton Baker, and because of that, Scylla ran in Charlton's name, and Charlton Baker now with a Grade 2 victory, not you.
So, yeah.
Tell me that story.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. I don't go to New York very often. I mean, we sent her up there last year to the Frisette, Bentley Combs, who I'd stabled beside at the fairgrounds a couple of years, was up there and was able to handle that duty for me up there. And actually last year, because I had COVID at the time, I was unable to attend or go. So it worked out really well. So this year when we made up our mind that we were going to the Prioress, I'd looked into getting my license and so forth and doing some things and talked to quite a few trainers that have been up there and done that. And everybody told me how much of a hassle it was just to go for one horse one time and the aspects of the workman's comp and the labor board and so forth that you had to go through. It wasn't just, you know, straightforward with the commission. My workman's comp's through the Louisiana program, and New York doesn't recognize that. And so the young lady that rubs this filly, that takes care of her, used to work for actually Charlie, and put me in contact with Charlie. He was more than obliging to help me out, and I was able to send the filly to him for a couple of days, let her train over there a day or two, and subsequently run. So it all worked out. I don't get the mark by my name. I guess I can carry it with me with an asterisk or something. But it just made business a lot easier to do. And another thing that's always in the back of my mind since having COVID and myself and spending time in the hospital, I'm just afraid of it. You know, it scares me. And if something would happen where somebody got sick or something and nobody could go, at least somebody was there, you know, that could look after the filly and everything kind of would go forward without hindering her chances to go ahead and compete.
So your bout with COVID, you were not asymptomatic by any stretch of the imagination. This was a serious situation for you.
I was sick. I was pretty bad sick. I fought it for 10 days at the house, in quarantine, and it was, I thought I had it whipped. I mean, I had people checking on me, you know, coming to the door and poking their head in and checking on me. And I thought I had it whipped. At about the 10th day, I just flat couldn't breathe anymore. And actually called an ambulance on myself and loaded up and went in, and they kept me for 5 days. Ran all the gauntlet of medications through me, and fortunately I come out on the other end, you know, much the wiser. And you know, it's for real. I can tell you, it's for real.
Yeah. Do you look at things a little bit differently now after going through something like that?
Yeah, I do. I do look at it quite a bit differently. You know, you don't. Yeah, that's the best way to put it. Your optics are way different after, you know, you've dealt with it. And subsequently since then, I've had family members die from it. You know, nobody can put a finger on it. But, you know, it played a big part in, you know, some decision makings as far as shipping, you know, and doing things. And you know, you start questioning whether putting people at risk is the right call sometimes, you know, to move them around and you know, to walk through that crowd at Saratoga, I definitely was, you know, it had my attention, you know, and, you know, you do it because this is what we do. We, you know, we have to go, we have to run these horses. You know, you have to go where you have to go, but it's always in the back of my mind nowadays. I promise you, it does play its part.
You bring up a good point too, Brett. It's not just about you. It's about the people that work with you and for you. And when you're sending a horse, the horse has to be accompanied by somebody, right? And if you're not going to saddle the horse, then there's other interests to think about other than just yourself. And that's the world we're living in now. It's the environment that trainers are dealing with as we continue to battle through this pandemic. How much has that changed your operation and the way you approach it?
It's changed it quite a bit, I'll tell you. You know, I send a string to New Orleans every year. And last year, you know, it played a big part on how we handle things. I didn't send near the help that I always send. I didn't send near the horses I always send. I kept it down to a bare minimum. I made sure that, you know, my guys were, you know, just extra precautionary, you know, checking up on them, making sure everything was, you know, done. Both of my guys got, you know, I had two guys, an exercise rider and my assistant, got sick down there last year. You know, and, you know, it's just you're, you know, before anybody, any of us could get vaccinated. So you're worried about, you know, having to run in there, having a guy on standby to go in there at any cost as soon as, you know, somebody was down and out, you know. So it's another weight put on top of the pile, you know.
Talking with trainer Brett Brinkman here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Fresh off that win in the Grade 2 Prioress, as you heard, it wasn't him. It was Charlie Baker who saddled the horse. He'll get the credit for the Grade 2 win. But Scylla has been a Louisiana-bred filly that has been with Brett, and this is certainly a win that he will cherish, no doubt. Even though you weren't there, even though it won't show on your record, Brett, tell me about the performance. What was your overall overview of this effort?
Well, I'll go back to the race at Keeneland. When we'd run her at Keeneland, we come away from there with what we felt like was the reason why she didn't perform to our expectations. And, you know, you never really know till you go back to battle again whether you were right or you were wrong. And we felt like we were right. So when we went back and took on the state breds, I had her entered that night against the three-year-old fillies in the Champions Day race at Evangeline. And I had her double entered against the older fillies in Mare Sprinting, and made the call that morning to run her against the older fillies in Mare Sprinting instead of going a route against straight three-year-old fillies. And took a little heat from a couple different people, you know, but they weren't involved. They were just being critics, and mainly the jock that was named on her against three-year-old fillies. But we went and took on the older mares, and she ran what I felt like was her effort. I mean, that's the first time that I felt like she really showed who I was seeing in the morning. And Mr. Ladner, who co-owns her with me and co-breeder with me, our plan was after that race to go directly north. I send a small string to Delaware every summer, and we were going to put her up there and then pick us out a race to step forward from there. So we picked out the race at Monmouth, got lucky, and it came off the grass and got to run on the dirt. And again, she paired up that effort back. So, you know, we felt like we were on the right track. We felt like she was coming into her own. Then I penciled in the Charlestown Oaks and the Prioress as the one of two spots. And just felt like we wanted to keep her sprinting. Her mother, who I trained, stretched out as a three-year-old and went two turns, but was way more effective around one turn. And this filly just continues to follow in her footsteps from a standpoint of training in the morning. She's looking more and more just like her mother has been, did at that time. So we elected to go to the Prioress, and, she didn't disappoint. She stepped forward, ran her effort, beat what I feel is like a pretty nice filly and super sensational. And, she left it out there on the racetrack. You know, she battled with her and got back in front of her and got there for the win. So.
And then you had to sit there and watch as the inquiry sign was posted. It wasn't easy, right? It never is.
Yeah, it never is. I mean, it's never easy. It's totally out of your hands. You know, it's in the judge's hands. I did feel like, you know, both fillies were marginally at fault to some degree. I can't fault Tyler. When you watch the head-on down the backside, Santana was really battling with Tyler down the backside for position. They were riding pretty tight, and I think Santana kept trying to push him down inside and hold him down inside, and Tyler did an excellent job of holding his position. And you know, I kind of thought there in the turn maybe we were going to come out on the worse end of it, because it looked like Super Sensational was getting a little bit better spot. And Tyler did an excellent job of battling back. I think that the both fillies kind of paid for it a little bit on the end, because I think they were battling early. You know, when they left the 3/8 pole, they kind of got in gear and both went to battling each other.
Yeah. And then when they came to the 8th pole, Super Sensational looked like she had put her away. And as you said, Scylla kept battling and came back on her inside and was able to get up and win it in the end. Did you know she had that kind of fight to her?
Yeah, you know, not really. I didn't really know she had that kind of fight. The allowance win at the fairgrounds when Kobe Hernandez rode her, she showed some grit, you know, on the end of that race and stuff, and some fight. And I'm still debating whether that's the grit and the determination. I'm going to tell you it is right now. But I still want to think there's a little bit of greenness still in this mare. I still think she's a little bit just not quite battle hardened yet. She's just kind of starting to figure this whole game out, in my opinion. The race at Monmouth kind of gave me a little bit of an illusion that she had figured it out. And then watching the replay and stuff and watching how he got into her and how he got busy, and then she went right back and put a whole neck on her and so forth. You know, she's had three different riders in the last three races, so it's a little hard to get feedback from those guys. You know, if the same rider had ridden her, I could maybe get a little bit better feedback. But I still think that the hammer hasn't quite fell all the way yet. You know, that she's still kind of learning some things.
What did Tyler Gaffalione have to say after the race?
Not much. Yeah, you know, he was just very complimentary on how she reacted to his, you know, to his questions. And you know, when he asked her, she gave forth. You know, I asked him about the coming in. He said, I think I just, you know, got into her a little hard, and she just kind of got in. He said, I don't think it was, you know, nothing more than that. I can tell you, you know, I like the way she came back and you know, went back to the track today, looked super. You know, he was just complimentary on how she handled and stuff.
Well, Scylla is now 5-for-10 lifetime. She's 4-for-6 this year. So 4 of her 5 wins coming in 2021. And you just mentioned she's starting to kind of figure it out, Brett. Are there things that you look for as a trainer that tell you a horse is starting to maybe turn the corner and figure things out?
Yeah, you know, you just see things in the mornings. You know, I can tell you, I'll just give you, for instance, with this filly, up until the Evangeline race, this filly, you couldn't get her to work in the mornings by herself. I mean, she'd work, but she'd work, you know, she might go a half in 52 or 53.
Yeah.
With her ears pricked around there. You know, and you put her with another horse and she just sit off that horse's hip and they could go in 47. It didn't matter. She just sit right there as long as you want her to sit there. So, you know, those kind of things have kind of evolved and changed. Now, you know, you can get the work out of her that you're asking for in the mornings by herself. You know, you can hit the number you're looking for. You can go out there and work in 48 or 49. And, you know, in fact, the morning she worked at Delaware in 59, she jumped a shadow and pricked her ears coming to the wire.
Oh, wow.
You know, there's still a certain level of greenness. And, you know, I say that in watching that race, you know, at Saratoga, that was her first time over that racetrack. I mean, she had never seen that racetrack, and she's the kind of mare that, you know, I think she's really visual. She sees a lot of things, and, you know, that's just who she is.
Is this the first graded stakes winner that you have bred?
Yeah, I think it is.
Cool.
You know, I've been breeding horses since I was in high school, so it's a little hard for me to tell you with definite that it is the first graded stakes winner I've bred, but I think it is. I think I've had maybe some graded stakes placed horses, but never a graded stakes winner.
You mentioned earlier Mr. Ladner, Dale Ladner, who is the co-breeder and the owner of Scylla. Tell me a little bit more about that relationship.
Oh, Dale, he's a great guy. It's just to give you a little background on the whole deal. I had a really nice 2-year-old colt, Louisiana bred, and Mr. Ladner had one as well. And I wasn't training for him at the time. And we hooked up a time or two and run against one another. And we were at the races one night. My girlfriend and I, and we went to get us a quick little bite at the restaurant, and we went up to the bar and just sat at the bar and got an appetizer and got a little bite to eat, and then we were heading to run one, and Mr. Ladner was sitting there, so I introduced myself because I knew who he was, but I'd never met him, and introduced myself to him, and we talked for a little bit just there sitting at the bar just visiting, and about a week later, he calls me up and he says, I was thinking if you might want to listen to a proposal I got. And he kind of spun his proposal to me. So we ended up doing some business together. And the first horse we ended up buying at a sale was Scylla's mother sitting at the bar. So, and he named her Sitting at the Bar because that's where we had met. That's
perfect.
Where it's gone from there.
Yeah. Perfect. And that was another, Sitting at the Bar was another Louisiana bred mare that, as you mentioned, you trained. 11 wins from 19 starts. I'm sitting here looking at her record right now, $705,000 in earnings. She was certainly no slouch.
No, she was pretty special, I tell you. You know, she was special from a standpoint that, you know, it's kind of come along at a time when I was just really starting to train full time. And, you know, she just made it a lot of fun. And, you know, to have a filly like that that dominated in a class for 3 years, you know, in the state bred class and so forth, you know, just was a whole lot of enjoyment there. And, you know, really got Dale really pumped up on the business and stuff. So
it's a great way to start a relationship, isn't it?
It sure is. It sure is.
Yeah, get a filly like this. And, you know, quite frankly, that I'm sure gave Dale an awful lot of confidence in you, Brett. And I know you're appreciative for the opportunity he gave you and for calling you up and spinning that proposal by you. But it gives the owner a lot of confidence in a trainer when they have a horse together and the horse has success. And now you come back with Scylla and she wins a grade two. You know, these are how owner-trainer relationships grow in the sport of thoroughbred racing.
Oh, exactly. And it's, you know, and being able to participate as a partner and so forth. I mean, it just, you know, it brings it to a whole different level, you know, just really rounds it out.
So what's next for Scylla?
We're kind of kicking it around. You know, obviously we've had some phone calls on her and stuff, but you know, like Mr. Ladner said, he's an accountant. So, you know, you're talking to a person that, you know, counts beans for a living. So he's pretty set. He's not really looking to do a whole lot, but enjoy. And, you know, till they get to some crazy numbers, I don't think he's gonna blink very much. We're going to kind of keep our eye on the prize. I honestly think this mare is going to be a you know, barring any bad luck, we're going to have a really good 4-year-old campaign with her. The racing, the sprint older mare division opens up a little bit more than the 3-year-old division does. You know, we're kicking around a couple of options. We're going to look at a couple of different options, but probably come back to Louisiana in November, run her on Champions Day in December, and then look at a 4-year-old campaign.
Talking with trainer Brett Brinkman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. He is a native of Lafayette, Louisiana, and I told you has now saddled 569 career winners and having a wonderful year in 2021. A lot of it courtesy of Scylla, but he has had other horses who have run extremely well too, and we'll talk about those as we move throughout the program. Brett, let's go back to the beginning and tell me about growing up in Lafayette and being around horses for the first time. How'd you get started?
My grandfather was a trainer. You know, he kind of did it part-time, but he trained horses all his life. Had an uncle that was a blacksmith on a racetrack. And, you know, from when I could follow him to the barn, that's what I'd done. I mean, I'd follow him to the barn. He'd carry me back to the house with a broke leg. You know, I'd get into some kind of trouble, it seemed like, all the time. But you know, I grew up doing that, just following in his footsteps. And then I had an aunt and uncle that ran a big farm in Ocala, outside of Ocala, actually. And I started going there every summer. I'd spend the summers there, and I'd come back to Louisiana and go back to school. And then when I was 12, I went and I stayed, and I didn't go back to Louisiana. I stayed in Florida, and then that was home. I ended up finishing school in Florida, going to college there, and just grew up there and went into the business, you know, just evolved into the business. I ended up, you know, working on the family farm there and just doing everything from A to Z, and ended up picking up a job with Arthur Appleton at Bridalwood Farms, and did a stint there. I think I worked there for about 8 years in different division manager capacities, and then went to work for Bill and Corinne Hollygrove for like 15 years, and broke and trained a bunch of horses for them on the farm and so forth. and actually started going. I started going back to Louisiana. I built a farm there while I was living in Florida, and started participating in their breeding program. My aunt had a farm still in Florida, and she was getting up in age. And the Breeders' Awards and so forth was just so bad in Florida at that time that I just watched her breed good horse after good horse, and never really got rewarded for it because of the way the Breeders' Award situation was set up. So I built that farm in Louisiana, started foaling some mares out there and so forth, and then went back there and started training there on a small scale, and it just kind of blew up from there.
Well, and it blew up in a big way because things have been going in the right direction for Brett Brinkman. Brett, we're about 2 minutes away from the commercial break here at the bottom of the hour, but you mentioned the fact that you were in Louisiana. You went to Florida to be with your aunt and uncle and spend the summer there, and at age 12, you stayed there and you attended college. Where did you go to college?
At Santa Fe Community College. It's a little community college there by the University of Florida.
Did you study equine-related topics, or was it something
completely different? No, actually, I was, you know, like every horse enthusiast, I was wanting to go, you know, pre-vet and so forth. But, you know, I was just taking basic courses there. I just went through a two-year course deal there, and then got out of that and just got really burnt out for a while. I got burnt out on, you know, working the farm, working horses and so forth, and I had to take a break, and I ended up doing something different for about 2 years. Just had a friend of mine that was building houses, just going into the construction industry. So I went and helped him get off the ground and get started and stuff. Just needed a break, just needed to kind of get away from it all for a little while. We used to tease my uncle because my cousin and I, we told him he was the reason child labor laws were invented.
Well, I know that I'm very glad that you got back into thoroughbred racing, and I know that certainly there are a lot of people that are. And as you said, you kind of took the necessary steps when you got back. What was it that drew you back in?
It was just in my blood. You know, I can vividly still remember the day, you know, that I was driving home and said, you know, okay, I feel good. I'm refreshed. I'm hungry for it. I want it back. You know, before I was just working, you know, it was a thing that I got up every morning. I went to the farm, I went to the barn, you know, whatever my uncle wanted. You know, if he needed me to go work for the neighbor next door because their farm manager got hurt, well, then that's where I would go, you know. And then I think I just needed a break from, you know, the family. I just needed a break from the industry for a little while to appreciate it and to understand it a little better. And when I came back, then I was more focused on attaining a level, you know, hacking it.
Well, yeah, that certainly makes sense, and it's been a ride. It's been one heck of a ride for Brett Brinkman. I'll continue this conversation when we come back. This is Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.
Nominations are still open for the Phasic Tipton November Sale, the world's premier breeding stock event. Last year, the sale produced the 8 highest-priced fillies and mares sold at any U.S. breeding stock sale, led by Monomoy Girl, selling for $9.5 million. 22 horses sold for $1 million or higher, and the sale also produced the co-highest-priced weanling sold in the U.S. last year. Nominate your best today to the Phasic Tipton November Sale, a night of stars, Tuesday, November 9th in Lexington, Kentucky. Where will you sell? Consistent success tested over time. There is no better example than Millridge Farm. Founded in 1962 by Alice Chandler, this year's inductee into the Hall of Fame as Pillar of the Turf. Since 2000, Millridge has raised or sold 36 Grade 1 winners, including 8 Breeders' Cup winners and 2 Horses of the Year. Millridge offers its largest and highest quality consignment ever at this year's Fasig Tipton Saratoga Sale, with 9 yearlings by leading stallions and promising first-year sires. And we'll be showing at Barn 5 on Friday, August 6th. Millridge, standing the test of time. The richest meet in Oak Lawn's history begins Friday, December 3rd through Sunday, May 8th. The 66-day meet will offer more than $45 million in purses with 36 stakes races totaling $12.3 million. And all allowance races are now worth $100,000. Oak Lawn boasts the richest Triple Crown prep series in the country, highlighted by the $1 million Rebel on Friday, February 26th, and the Grade 1 Arkansas Derby Saturday, April 2nd, now offering a purse of $1.25 million. Learn more at oaklawn.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Three of them across the track. Eenie Meenie Miney Moe, Scylla in the white blinkers, Super Sensational on the outside, Oksana trying to get back in it again down at the rail. The half mile in 45 seconds, and now there's a furlong to the finish. Super Sensational on the outside grabs the lead from Scylla. It is Super Sensational. Scylla's not done yet. She is coming back again. Scylla and Super Sensational. They come on for the finish in the Prioress Stakes, and Scylla won it. Scylla defeats Super Sensational. Little Tootsie rallied for third. 6 furlongs in 1 minute, 10 seconds.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you as always on this program. That was John Embriel with the call of the Grade 2 Prioress at Saratoga this past Saturday. A gutsy victory by Louisiana-bred Scylla to get past Super Sensational. After being passed in the stretch, she battled back to get the victory for trainer Brett Brinkman, and he will not get the credit. We told you that story in the first half of the show. Officially, it will go to Charlie Baker, who saddled the horse because Brett was not there. But it is still a huge win for Brett Brinkman, who is my special guest on the program today. Going to continue the visit right after I remind you that if you missed any portion of this Trainer Talk show or any of our shows, all you have to do is go to our website, horseracingradio.net, and you can check out the podcast of this program and all of our shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts or wherever you access your podcasts. Well, Brett, that was a special day. We talked about it in the first half of the show. How many times have you gone back to watch the race since that victory?
I watched it about 3 or 4 times, but till I watched the whole race head on is when it really kind of everything clicked. The whole pan shot and everything. I mean, it gives you a view of it, but the head on from the gate really gives you an idea on what those jocks were doing and how these horses were battling from the get go. Actually, so
yeah, it definitely gives you a different perspective. I do like that. I always like to kind of switch from the pan shot to the head on, and because even when there is no incident, and again, we talked about the fact that there was an inquiry, an objection after the race, but even when there is no incident, it gives you a whole different perspective on the way the race was run.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of the, you know, I'm not going to say the gamblers, but a lot of the racing enthusiasts that follow racing, you know, the jocks, especially jocks out of, you know, the high level riders that you get at Saratoga, I mean, they're riding their race from the start. They don't just start at the quarter pole riding. They're riding their race from the start of the race, and you know, you can watch these guys, and they're really, really wanting their position early. They're wanting to dictate the race. They're wanting their horse in its best position to win at all times, and you can really see it watching it from the head on.
I've had so many conversations with jockeys over the years, and we'll talk about their preparation to ride, whether it's a big race or really any race, but certainly a big race. And they'll talk about watching replays of the horses they're going to be aboard and the other horses that they're riding against so that they'll know the tendencies of those other horses, just like, you know, say a football team would study the tendencies of the team that they're going to play. Jockeys do the same thing. Do trainers do that too? Brett, do you sit down and watch replays of some of the other horses you're going to be competing against so maybe you can make a decision as to how your horse should be ridden, for example?
In a big race such as that, I do. You know, the only thing I said to Tyler in the race was the fact that, you know, obviously, the tour board was telling us the same thing. We had to outrun Super Sensational, I mean, for the win. If you're going to win it, you're going to have to outrun her. And her style is a lot like our style. I mean, it was a stalk and pounce kind of style. And I think when we left the gate Saturday, we actually were in front. Now, that's one of the few times that Scylla was actually in front first step away from the gate. Mm-hmm. But I think that shows you that Tyler was wanting to dictate where he was at and make Santana have to follow us a little bit. And then Santana countered and, you know, tried to get jump on him, you know, going into the turn and make us have to come and follow him. So that's where the battle kind of started, you know, probably about the 3.5. And, I think there's two fillies with the same kind of style of running and two jocks realizing that they're on. So it set up that battle.
And it was a battle that was won by Scylla. Brett, let's go back to something you were talking about in the first half of the program before the commercial break. You had mentioned the fact that you attended college in Florida and then stepped away from horse racing and from the industry for a couple of years, maybe a little bit burnt out. You got back into it, and then you mentioned a couple of really prominent names in the sport. You mentioned going to work at Bridlewood for Arthur Appleton and then the High League Bros. Tell me about those experiences.
Oh, I had the opportunity to go to work for Mr. Appleton. I was 27 at the time, and they needed a division manager to come in and take care of his yearlings and his. They have a hospital barn there that took care of all the rehab horses and so forth. So I stepped into that position, and then it evolved into the training position, and I also did the sales for them. That was a huge, huge operation at the time. We were raising anywhere from 100 to 140 head of babies every year. And it was just a great growing and learning experience there. The manager that came in after I was hired there, a gentleman by the name of Richard Kent, we evolved into buying some weanlings and started participating in the sales a lot more. Mr. Appleton had never really sold horses. So we kind of evolved the operation a little bit. And one of the first sales we went to buy weanlings, I bought a filly for him, Richard and I did, by the name of Picture. And she was from the first crop of Rahi.
Okay.
And ultimately she turned out to be Serena Song.
Wow.
We were buying some weanlings to turn around at the time. Keeneland had a July sale, and we were buying some weanlings to have a July sale consignment. So we put her in the July sale consignment, and we absolutely loved her. She was a really neat horse, but she was bought primarily for that purpose. And we ended up, I think we bought her for 42. Somewhere along in there, you have to excuse my memory as far as that's concerned, but we ended up selling her for 100.5 to Mr. and Mrs. Lewis, and she ended up turning into Serena Song. And the next November, we went and bought her mother, carrying a full sibling to her. So it ended up turning out really well. We got the golden goose. We let the egg go, but we had the golden goose. So.
Yeah,
it was an experience to watch all that unfold and stuff. But it was a lot of fun raising her. She was absolute class act, even just raising her from a weanling to a yearling.
you just never know, right? You said you liked her, you were really high on her, and you can make all the right moves, and you can see all the right things, but you still don't know that she's going to turn out to be Serena's son, no. The Hall of Famer, right?
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's kind of funny because you just look at it and you have feelings, you have a gut, you know, a gut kind of stance on the whole thing. But she, you know, how many times have we been hit in the gut, you know, with the same feeling?
Yep.
And, you know, it just, sometimes things are just meant to be. You know, she was supposed to get into Lewis's hands. She was supposed to be in Dwayne's hands, and she was supposed to turn out the way she turned out. That's just the way it was supposed to happen.
Do you think Mr. Appleton regretted the decision to sell her, knowing, you know, you can't tell, but knowing what she went on to do? Do you think there were ever regrets there?
Every day.
Yeah.
Every day. You know, it was funny when, you know, after that was all said and done, that whole operation with me there and Richard himself, Richard and I continue to be good friends. And he told me, he sat down one day, and in our course of working there, that we had sold over 800 head of horses through the auction ring while we were working there. And of the 800, he wanted 7 of them back.
Yeah.
and I go, you don't have to tell me who's at the top of the list. I know that one.
You know, but that's incredible. You think about how difficult it is to get a horse of that caliber in this sport. And I talk about this a lot on the show. Just to get a horse into the starting gate for their maiden race is a massive accomplishment. But to get a horse, a home run horse like a Serena Song, you mentioned 800 horses, only 7 would be the ones that he would want back. I mean, that's not a good percentage.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
And then you ask people, why would anybody want to play in this game? What is it that makes people want to play in this
game? It's the 7.
Yep.
It's those 7. You know, it's the chance of grabbing that one of those 7. You know, and look, you know, you have to look at the process. You know, you have to have faith in your process and what you're doing. And, you know, that's why, you know, when you look at the numbers out of a 2-year-old sale and everybody says, oh, such good horses come out of the 2-year-old sales. Well, you have to look at the horses that are going through most of those 2-year-old sales. They've been through the public scrutiny process. I mean, they've been judged by several eyes, you know, and picked and selected and, you know, basically honed to go into these 2-year-old sales and stuff. So, you know, it's the process that that these horses go through, the selection process, that makes, you know, kind of narrows everything down to making it a successful operation.
No, it's a great point. And this show has been sponsored for many, many years now by our friends over at Phasic Tipton. And they have been told on multiple occasions that there are so many people that listen to this program and have been on this program that obviously attend their sales. How much time, Brett, will you spend throughout the year going to the horse sales, looking for that next superstar? Is that something you do?
Oh, I'd love to spend a lot more time. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of owners at this point in time that buy a lot of yearlings. So I do go and I do buy some. But there was a time where I used to look at every horse in the Keeneland September and November sale, every baby, every yearling for years.
Wow.
You know, when I was working for Bill and Corinne and even working with Mr. Appleton. You know, we'd look at a lot of horses, and I think that's part of what made Phasic, you know, the huge resurgence that Phasic had, and so forth. You know, Mr. Graves and those guys, they had an awesome, awesome bunch of horsemen on their committee that would come and look and inspect, and you know, they would pick out horses, and you know, when the buyers came to the horse sales at Phasey Tipton, they would, every horse they pulled out was kind to the eye. I mean, you know, you could really go there expecting to see athletes.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Yeah, I mean, that's what everybody is in this game for. They're looking for that next athlete, and you're right that the team at Phasic has had that resurgence, and it's been remarkable to see where things are today. Talking with Brett Brinkman here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Tell me more about working with the Heilig Bros.
Oh, they were great people. I tell you, they're just fabulous. The whole family is really, really good people, and you know, Bill's just consummate sportsman, just loves the game and loves the industry and stuff. Really, really, really loves fast horses. I mean, just wants fast horses. You know, I remember he sent a horse up from Texas one time that was raised in Texas, and he was a good-looking horse. And at the time, John Kimmel was training for us, and we sent the horse to John, and he turns out to be a really, really good grass horse, and Bill just couldn't believe it. He's like, "That's the fastest horse I had in Texas," and I'm like, "John says he's a grass horse," and he's like, and the horse ended up winning some graded stakes on the grass and so forth, and was very successful. But he's like, "Oh no, he's fast. He's fast. Yeah, he's fast, but he says he's a grass horse." Bill likes to go, he thinks a mile and a 16th is three races, so he really likes to go fast. So, but they're good, they're great people. I mean, really had a passion for the industry, and, you know, they're good for it. They're good for the business.
Where did you go after that?
After that, I went on my own. You know, I went out on my own and started doing things, you know, just myself. You know, and I really didn't own a lot of horses at that point. You know, I kind of built into that as I started having, you know, better horses to race and so forth and so on. Then I started owning some and doing that. You know, got in with Dale on sitting at the bar, and then I've had some other stakes filled and so forth. And yeah, I have to try to breed better horses. You know, it's hard for me to go and purchase the kind of horses I like to have. So I have to try to breed some of them. So I keep five or six broodmares, all stakes winning fillies.
How did you end up getting started then with your career? What was the one thing that kind of served as the catalyst to get you rolling?
I'm not sure I understand the question. It's kind of something I've done all my life. Like I said, I've been breeding horses since I was in high school. But
yeah, I guess the moment that launched your training career, where you said, "Okay, I can do this. This is going to be successful." Was there a horse something along those lines? Was there that moment?
Not really. I wanted to train. I like to get up every morning and go to the barn. You know, that's what I like. I mean, that to me, even if I don't have to go to the barn, I go to the barn. And you know, it's like my day is not complete unless I walk through the barn, you know, and take a look around and stuff. So, you know, I kind of like the competition. Instead of your Derby day being one breeze show at the sale and then, you know, everything hinging on walking that horse through the sales ring.
Yeah.
I like the opportunity to keep marching over there and competing. And, you know, I like that aspect of it. And, you know, you always have that opportunity of something different. I mean, you know, you can, you know, and there's no greater satisfaction than noticing something that's going to make one better. And that's kind of basically what it is. You know, you see something a horse is doing, you see something that you can improve on, that's to me, that's the ultimate. You know, it may only bring him from 5 to 10, but it makes him better. You know,
yeah, it's a great point. It's so rewarding when you know that you helped that horse compete at their maximum level or a level higher than where they were competing. Tell me about one of those stories, Brett. Do you have an example or two maybe of a horse that maybe didn't show that type of ability, but then you started working with them and you figured a couple of things out, and all of a sudden they took things to a new level?
Yeah, I won't mention any names, but I, you know, there's a filly at the fairgrounds that an owner of mine wanted to claim, and she was coming off of a layoff. This has been about 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. And we went and dropped a slip on her and stuff. She run dead last, and just really looked like she was struggling. And but we figured first race off the layoff, you know. So I brought her home, took a look at her, watched her cool out. She was sticky, a little sticky behind and stuff. So long story short, had my blacksmith look at her. We shot her different behind, just did a couple of little things behind on her. And she ended up going up the ladder, winning some allowance races for her, ended up being a starter filly. We went like 180,000 with her in the course of about 16 months.
Oh, wow.
You know, just, you know, it's just those kind of things. And I'm not saying she really had a huge problem, but, you know, we watched her, we paid attention to her, pulled her shoes off, trained her barefooted, watched how she wore her feet. You know, she wore them at a different angle than what they had her shod at. And, you know, just helped her out, you know, through some sense like that. So, you know, just like I said, it's just paying attention. You know, I've kind of gotten to the point where I have to split my stable, and I really don't like that a whole lot. I like to have all my horses under one roof if I can, but I'm fortunate enough to have some good help. I've got one guy that's been with me 20 years now. The other girl has been with me about 18 years. So, you know, they know me. They know how we like things, and they know when to throw the flag and say, you need to come look at this. You know, you need to see this. You need to, you know, we need to put our heads together and figure out what we need to do here.
How many horses do you have in training?
We've got 50 right now.
Yeah, it's a big number for somebody who likes to walk down the shed row and see all the horses. That's a big number.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got 40 under one roof at the moment, and that makes it nice. But, you know, in the wintertime, you know, I do have to split my time. I have to go to the fairgrounds. I have to go to Delta. Hats off to the Asmussens of the world. I mean, that's just unbelievable how they can accomplish it. That's just it just boggles my mind. But they're good at it.
Yeah, they're good at it, and they have good help. That's one thing that they've always told me when they've come on this show. I've asked them that question. How do you do it? Guys like Asmussen and Pletcher and, you know, Bill Mott that have these different strings. How do you do it? And they all cite the good help that they have in place, just like you did. Even if you only have 50 horses, that's a big number of horses that you have to take care of.
Yeah, and it's, you know, that aspect of it, that help situation is getting harder and harder. It's more of a battle nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah, Brett Brinkman, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fazy Tipton. Brett, we talked about Scylla. We talked about the Dam of Scylla sitting at the bar, who you also trained. Let's talk about some of the other horses that have come through your care that have put some serious money in the bank. And I'll just name it a horse, and you can go ahead and roll through it. How about Sadie's Soldier?
Yeah, he was special. Sadie was owned by a dear friend of mine, Mr. Harry Benoit. And been a huge advocate for racing in Louisiana. Sadie come from a really good family of state bred horses, a really fast mare that when they used to run the Jean Lafitte in at Delta Downs. And I think that mare winners was second in the Jean Lafitte. Really, really fast little state bred mare. And she ended up producing like five or six stakes horses. And Sadie might have been one of the last foals she had. And I've always been a fan of Lost Soldier. And Mr. Benoit, actually my uncle, bought this horse for Mr. Benoit out of the pasture. And as a yearling, he was just an ugly duckling, just big, leggy, really ugly duckling. And, you know, took a little while to evolve and just turned out to be a really good top-notch grass horse in the state. probably biggest regret is I never gave him the opportunity to go take on open company somewhere on the turf, because I really do think at a level in open company he could have competed. You know, I'm not going to say he was a Silla, but I think he could have won some open bred stake race somewhere on the grass, because he definitely had a world of talent at Orsted.
Well, I told you we were going to go through several, but I didn't realize this interview, this conversation has gone so quickly. We are just about wrapped up with the hour. I think we have about 3 minutes or so left. So I always like to end the program by asking trainers to tell us something that we haven't touched on yet, something that you might enjoy doing outside of racing, maybe other hobbies or sports that you follow or whatever it might be. So throw it out there, Brett. What other things do you enjoy doing?
Lord, that's a tough question for a trainer.
Yeah, it always is.
It really is. I tell you, from a trainer's aspect, which probably wouldn't get this answer from most trainers, I really enjoy going watch my babies in the field. Just growing up, I like to look at those babies and just walk around in the pasture looking at them. That to me, it's something I grew up doing, and I still really, really enjoy that part of it. I love going to anybody's farm and walking out in the pasture and looking at their baby.
Yeah, that is a different answer. Quite often, I'll get the answer from trainers that they really don't have any other hobbies because this takes up so much of your time, and you have to be so singularly focused if you're going to be successful. And it does sound like you're kind of in that camp too.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I don't fish. I don't golf. You know, I don't do those kind of things. I'm a big livestock person, and I'll even go ride somewhere and look at somebody's cows. I mean, I just really like going looking at livestock and, you know, just seeing, you know, good quality, you know.
Well, you've picked out a lot of quality horses. You bred quality horses, and I know that there are more in your future too. And it has been so much fun to catch up with you and to hear your story and kind of powwow over some of those top moments. And congratulations again on that big win for Silla this past weekend.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity, and you have a blessed day.
Yeah, you too, Brett. Appreciate it. Brett Brinkman here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Fun show. I mean, there's a guy, his enthusiasm is infectious. He loves the game. Just loves the sport. Loves being around the horses, as you heard him say. Fantastic. If you missed any portion of the show, head to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out the podcast at your leisure. Follow us on social media, at HRRN on Twitter, Horse Racing Radio Network on Facebook. For my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studio, for my special guest, Brett Brinkman, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.